It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. I've got a new condiment for you. It's called BizBaz. You make it in about 5 minutes, and this could be your new mayonnaise, salsa, marinade. You get the gist. BizBaz is from Somalia, and I was introduced to it by Somalian chef Jamal Hashi. It's this cool pale green sauce, and it's done with fresh coriander and lime and garlic and chili, and then you stir in Greek yogurt. Now, Jamal serves his BizBaz with slow-roasted goat and his camel burgers, but my approach is a little more prosaic. I like it on everything. Anyway, a lot more ideas are coming up this hour on The Splendid Table. This podcast is brought to you by EasyCanvasPrints.com, turning your photos into works of art. Get your favorite photos on canvas. Visit EasyCanvasPrints.com, click the microphone in the top right-hand corner. Enter Splendid Table to receive 50% off.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Okay, I have to admit this. I'm a pushover for the people who go deep into their subjects. And one is Australian chef David Thompson. This man lives for Thailand. And right now, I'm paging through his new book, Thai Street Food. And one word comes to mind. Alive. The book is a monster. It's jammed with photos, but you could walk into those pages and be there. Well, David joins us from his restaurant kitchen in London. David, good to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
David, this book is just amazing. It truly is not just beautiful, but it does feel like you are in the midst of these marketplaces. You're at these food stands.
It almost makes you want to rub whatever you find on the soles of your feet off, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, yes, exactly. But I know that Thailand is intoxicating. I mean, people love it. But what has been the pull for you?
I don't know. I went there by mistake. And I just
by mistake? Fell in love.
Yeah, one of those serendipitous accidents. And I just went there. I was meant to go to another place, to Tahiti, ended up in Thailand instead. It's not that I so much I got on the wrong plane, but just circumstances changed. And I went there with no expectation of really liking it, just having a little time away. And I became seduced by the place, the people, the cuisine, so many aspects of that very agreeable place. And I moved over to Thailand, and, well, it's continued on. It's something that I find intoxicating, no, enthralling. You know, you're talking about walking through the markets and feeling that zest and that delight and that allure, and I still find that after 30 years of trawling through the markets.
It's been 30 years. That's a lot of time.
I was only 2 years old, of course.
Yes, you were in swaddling clothes. Yeah, yeah. But do this for me, though. I want this to come alive for everybody. Walk us through that market. Take us briefly through a day in the street food of Thailand.
The markets have a different schedule than the rest of the world, really. It's still agricultural, so most of the people in the markets get up at 3 in the morning or 4 in the morning as they bustle around and start to prepare for the day. They may get to the markets at 4 in the morning and they may begin to casually, slowly, sleepily open up their shops. But then just as dawn begins, just as dawn breaks, what happens is that the monks arrive. The monks leave their temples after their morning prayers and then start to make their morning rounds to receive the alms from the faithful. And then customers start to arrive and the morning kind of begins. But the markets aren't just about a commercial transaction.
Uh-huh.
It's much, much, much more than that. People may arrive and have a coffee in the morning and breakfast, which may consist of some deep fried bread, or indeed if somebody's been up since 4 o'clock in the morning, it might also mean some little sugar cakes or some Khom Jin noodles, which are rice noodles just topped with a really quite spicy sauce. And whilst business is being transacted, they still, how may I say it, they still enjoy doing things in that they will make a joke. It's not just about business alone, it's about the pleasure and the grace with which they make that transaction. So they'll make a joke, they'll banter. And the reason why I like the market so much, Lynn, is because you see the real side of ties, not just the polite, formal, whining ties who behave so perfectly and so gracefully. You see the rambunctious, rapscallion, noisy, bantering that makes that country so delightful, because it's not perfect, nor prim, nor proper entirely. It's also alive. It's also biting. It's also, well, it's delicious and chaotic and noisy, and for all those reasons, heart-rendering.
So now we go to lunch, and you've divided the book this way. You call morning, noon, and dinner, or night. But what kind of things would I be eating at lunch?
Well, the thing is, to be honest, the breaking it down to morning and afternoons and stuff like that is putting it in a way that we'd understand in the West. But for a Thai, they eat throughout the day. So they might have two bowls of noodles here, a bowl of noodles there, some deep-fried bread here, then move on to some snacks, and then on to lunch and then on to dinner. One of the things about the Thais is that they're the most tolerant people. They're the most gracious people. They're the most hospitable people. But the one thing I've found that will make them never forgive you is if you get in the way between them and their food. But in the morning, you know, the breakfast sort of seeps into kinder, gentler snacks. So there'll be the first beginnings of some desserts, like some steamed sugar cakes or some grilled bananas, that help you over that difficult period, that uncertain period between a full breakfast and an expectant lunch.
Yes. You have a recipe in here for charred rice noodles with chicken, as I recall, and wild ginger. This sounds like, you know, all of Thailand in a bowl.
All of Thailand can be found in a bowl, and some of the noodle dishes are Chinese in origin, especially some of the rice noodles. But some of the Khmer Jin noodles, and that's the one that you're talking about, are the local noodles, the indigenous noodles that have been part and parcel of Thai since they entered into Thailand.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, those types of noodles that are sort of round spaghetti-like things are the only noodles that you can eat with curries. And there's sauces that top them off are curry-like, where there's lots of wild ginger, and say in the instance that you were talking about, some chicken that's been poached and pounded and then mixed with a curry paste with a ridiculous amount of wild ginger, which gives it a pungency that's agreeable and bracing if you're having it in the morning and necessary if you're having it in the afternoon.
David, the food sounds incredible. Thank you so much for talking with us.
It's a great pleasure, and I hope that I've managed to entice you to come to Thailand.
I think you have.
Fantastic.
David Thompson works with the Thai government in recording little-known regional recipes. His book is Thai Street Food. Try a dish you don't find in many Thai restaurants, and that is charred rice noodles and chicken with thickened gravy. And it's on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, sign up for a chance to win our book of the month. And this month, it's a copy of Bought, Borrowed, and Stolen by Chef Allegra McEvity. It's there at splendidtable.org. Writers have hallmark styles. Gilt.com features editor Francis Lamb kind of dances with the recipes that he writes. Instead of that direct approach of, this is good, you should try it, he waltzes us around the dish so that we can enjoy it from a couple of different angles. Then he tells us how to make it. Well, Francis is back from a trip to Hong Kong. So Francis, I have a feeling we're going to be waltzing around a Chinese dish today, right?
You know, I grew up eating Chinese food my whole life, and, you know, I love it. I grew up with it. But let's face it, you know, it's not a cuisine that's really known for its prowess with desserts. But as I was walking around Hong Kong and the neighboring city, Macau, particularly, I found all these shops that specialize in this sort of weird ginger pudding. They're sort of milk shops or dairy shops which is unusual because you don't really expect a lot of that in Chinese cooking. But basically, they sell, you know, a few different variations on a really spicy, gingery custard that's made essentially with nothing more than ginger, milk, and sugar. It's kind of amazing. It's sort of magical. I mean, you could call it science, but, you know, if you're cold-blooded. But I want to believe in magic, so I'm just going to call it magic.
So how is it made?
Very simply, there are two methods. One is that you mix the ginger, milk, and sugar together. Ginger juice, rather. Very fresh ginger juice that you grate yourself. Uh-huh. That's important because if you get the bottled stuff, often it's heat pasteurized, and that'll kill the effect. But you take the fresh ginger juice, milk, and sugar, mix it up, set it in the bowls, put it in a steamer, and then steam it very gently. And then after, oh, it depends on the heat, but say, let's say 10 minutes, you'll have the lightest, laziest kind of custard. It's smooth and slippery, but it has a tiny bit of hold on your tongue. And it just sort of envelops your tongue, and, you know, the flavor of the ginger starts to warm it. It's really, really lovely.
Well, that sounds so good.
Yeah, totally. It's, you know, there is no egg and there is no starch, so there's nothing really that holds it together except this reaction that happens between the milk and this enzyme and the ginger juice. And it's a little bit, the enzyme, I believe, is called, it has this sort of fabulous name. It's called zingibane, which sounds like, you know, something you'd put on before you go out sunning or something. But, you know, the enzyme basically reacts with the milk at a certain temperature range, almost like rennet would if you were think of making cheese. It causes the milk proteins to denature and then coagulate.
So it's not that you heat milk and it thickens. It's that there's something in the ginger that reacts with the milk that makes the thickening happen.
Exactly. I mean, it does. You have to heat it. It has to happen in a certain temperature range between 140 to about 150 degrees Fahrenheit. The steaming technique, like I said earlier, is one of the two traditional techniques. And on the one hand, it's super easy because you set in the steam, you walk away. On the other hand, there's a little bit of a trick to it because it is delicate. And if you do overcook it, there's no gentle way to put it. It turns ugly. It turns beaten up and it curdles in that way you think of when things curdle. You know, things get clumpy. Underneath, it might still be lovely. It might still be smooth and delicious, but you just have to be careful when you're steaming. The other way to make it that is in a certain way safer, but usually doesn't produce quite as sturdy a custard, it's a little bit looser, is what they call crashing the milk. And what you do there is you heat the milk to almost boiling, about 180, 190, right when you start to have some bubbles and starts to foam and steam comes out. Right. You don't want to actually boil, but right to that point. Then you, again, quote, crash it, which means you pour it from the pot into, say, a pitcher, you know, with some air in between, you know, maybe a foot or two of distance. So it crashes from one to the other. You do that 10 times, and they say that'll bring you to the temperature you want. Now, if you want to use a thermometer, again, you want it really around 150 degrees Fahrenheit. And then you add it to ginger juice that's already in the bowl you're going to serve it in.
I see.
Yeah, and then it sets directly in the bowl after a few minutes.
And do you eat it just plain or do you serve it with other things or top it with something?
You know, I've seen recipes where people are like, oh, you serve it with fruit or you do things. I mean, I love it by itself. And particularly if you're not having a huge portion, it's so light and the flavors are so simple and yet complex, right? Because really all it is milk, sugar, and ginger. So you really taste all three of those things and how they interact with one another. And that's how I love it.
Sounds wonderful. Hey, Francis, thank you.
Thank you.
Francis Lam is features editor for GuiltTaste.com. Now, for that ginger milk pudding recipe, go to the website, splendidtable.org. One lesson from Francis's ginger pudding is that you have to keep an open mind. For instance, I've sneered at garlic powder forever. To me, it always tasted the way a chem lab smells. Then I had garlic powder made by a garlic farmer. And it was killer. It disappeared into nearly everything I cooked. So with a newly open mind, I have done a garlic powder tasting, gathering everything in my neighborhood. Now, there's more brands out there, but here's the worst and the best of what I found. My top pick was from Frontier Natural Products Co-op. It's sold in bulk, and it tastes like the real thing. The worst was McCormick's garlic powder. It smelled like a bouillon cube and tasted like what you get on bad pizzas. Now, you can find a list of the brands I sampled on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back in a moment with the most mysterious fish in the sea. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This podcast is brought to you by EasyCanvasPrints.com. Take your favorite family photos, pictures of the kids, or those amazing vacation photos and have them printed on canvas. Starting at $19.99, you can have a beautiful canvas print for your home or office. Visit EasyCanvasPrints.com, click the microphone in the top right-hand corner, and enter the promo code SPLENDIDTABLE to receive 50% off your canvas print. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our program is supported by the employee owners of Bob's Red Mill Natural Foods, stone millers of over 400 whole grain flours, hot cereals, and baking mixes. Bob'sRedMill.com. Whole grain foods for every meal of the day. And by 5 all-natural products from Europe, Grana Padano, Prosciutto di San Daniele, Montazio cheese, Prosciutto di Parma, and Parmigiano Reggiano. More at legendsfromeurope.com. This campaign is financed with aid from the European Union and Italy. Is any food issue getting more attention right now than our national school lunch program? Everybody's got an opinion, and everybody's got a solution. Well, we have Professor Brian Wansink. He's a marketing expert from Cornell University, and you might know his book, Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. Right now, he's running the Cornell Center for Behavioral Economics in Child Nutrition, and he has his own take. Brian, welcome back. Good to have you.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
It's good to have you with us. All right, so what does behavioral economics in child nutrition mean?
It's a way that we can guide children to make smarter choices in the lunchroom. One thing we know is that food is not nutritious until a child eats it. So the goal isn't just to have healthy food surrounding a child, because they can always choose the option of saying, hey, I'm not eating school lunch at all. I'm bringing chips from home. The goal instead is having a selection of stuff, but guiding a child toward picking up what's healthy and thinking it was their own volition that led them to do it. We find in our research, for instance, that the first thing that a child sees in line, they're 11% more likely to take than the fourth thing. Well, so you don't want the first thing to be the grilled cheese sandwich. You want the first thing to be the broccoli. It's very easy things that can be done to nudge people in the right direction versus the wrong direction. Let me give you an example. We were doing this really neat study a while back on how the payment systems in schools kind of bias kids to either take too much or buy the wrong stuff. And we were in this one school, and this woman says, you know, I'm a dietitian. I just took this job over 3 months ago. First thing I did was I banned chocolate milk. The second thing I did was I answered hate mail from weeks from kids and parents and teachers that said, why are you taking my chocolate milk away? And she said, you know, I just don't know what the solution is. And we looked at this, and when you walked in the lunchroom, the very first thing you saw was a big cooler of chocolate milk, and then there's a little bitty cooler of white milk like 10 feet later.
Right.
We said, here's what we do. We put all the white milk in this big cooler, and if somebody wants chocolate milk, they're going to have to walk around this cooler in this bottlenecked area, reach down and get it, and then they can actually have it. Well, she did that, and complaints went down to almost nothing, and chocolate milk sales went down dramatically because people said, you know, I don't want to wait for chocolate milk, but at least I have the choice.
So you've done actually a lot of tests in school situations, right?
Oh, tons.
So what's worked and what hasn't worked?
Well, I'll tell you a bunch of things that have worked, and I'll tell you some things that haven't worked. A big thing that's worked in a tremendous way is simply putting the fruit not in a nasty steel pan, but putting it in a really nice fruit bowl and just putting it on top of the counter where people actually see it, where it's well-lit, and where they can reach it. Increased fruit sales initially by about 180%. Okay,
that's impressive.
Yeah, over the end, by the end of the semester, it's gone down to just a little over 100%. But it doubles whole fruit. With schools that have breakfasts, we replaced the traditionally what's often used is an 18-ounce bowl for cereal with a 14-ounce bowl, and in self-service conditions, we found that it decreased the amount of cold cereal kids took by nearly 30%. Even changing trays out, we found that some schools are kind of going trayless. We looked at things and we said, you might save a little waste when you go trayless, but what's a kid with two hands not going to take if he'd otherwise get a salad, chicken, and a dessert? He's not going to leave the dessert behind, I'll tell you that. But I'll tell you what doesn't work.
Okay.
What doesn't work in the cases we've looked at are the schools that have banned something, like cookies or things like this. Because what happens is a decrease in the number of kids who eat school lunches. And in general, and this is a gross generalization, of the thousands of kids that I've seen eating high school and junior high lunches, middle school lunches, I'd say 3 out of 4 or 4 out of 5 kids who don't eat the school lunch eat worse.
Brian, thanks so much for talking with us.
That's great, as always.
Marketing professor Brian Wansink is head of the Cornell University Center for Behavioral Economics in Child Nutrition, which is funded by the USDA. You know, the eel is not the most endearing fish, especially for we Americans. It has a very high yuck factor. But that's us, and not the rest of the world. The eel is prime sustenance for many, and it's also mysterious for a lot of people, including scientists. For example, this is the only fish to spawn in deep ocean water, but it lives its life in fresh water in lakes and streams. Eels can travel miles on land, and they only become male and female when they swim back out to sea to breed. And then there's another aspect of the eel. James Prosek's book, Eels, takes us into a part of the world where eels are nearly sacred. James, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Lynn.
So what part of the world are eels nearly sacred? Where is this?
Well, I would say the most interesting indigenous stories I ran across were in the Pacific Islands. Eels play the role of monster seducers or guardians. They're involved in the origin myths of many of the important food trees like coconuts, bananas, breadfruit.
Huh.
They're an obvious kind of phallic symbol, so they are involved in stories. In the same way that the snake in the Garden of Eden story was sort of a seduction myth. But the stories that probably evolved in Indian Indonesia, where the snake plays that role of the monster seducer or guardian, trickled down with the people as they migrated through the Pacific Islands. And for the most part, snakes are not native to many of the islands, so the eel was the closest available counterpart.
Mm-hmm.
Why this creature... this limbless creature inspires fear, awe, and reverence in humans is anyone's guess. But, yeah, they're very important to Pacific Island people.
Do any of these cultures eat the eel? Or is it sacred it's not eaten?
It's interesting. Some do and some don't. I think the inclination was not to eat the eel historically because it was sacred. But where I traveled in Micronesia, I found that some islands didn't, some islands did, and the islands that did eat the eel were usually places where Christian missionaries or whalers had brought disease and had wiped out enough of the indigenous population that they couldn't remember the indigenous myths and the importance of the eel faded away. But places where the people had survived and their culture and languages survived, they tend not to eat the eel. But in New Zealand, they both revere the eel and eat the eel. But there's some eels they eat and some they don't eat. So it's kind of interesting.
This is New Zealand. Are these the native peoples of New Zealand?
Yeah, the Maori people are the indigenous Polynesians there. I would say the eel is probably the most important creature in the indigenous faith of the Maori, and probably the most important food source. You know, when people first landed in the North and South Island of New Zealand from the other Polynesian islands, the most abundant and wonderful source of food and easy to gather were these giant flightless birds, the moa birds. They were 12 feet tall. They were like flightless chickens, huge, wow. You know, so they actually wiped out 14 species of moa birds within 200 years of occupation. And then what they were left with was the coast where there's a lot of seafood. But on inland areas, the only significant sized and easiest to gather food source was the eel. New Zealand has the largest freshwater eels in the world. The longfin eels can grow 6-7 feet long. They can weigh over 80 pounds, and they're very long-lived. The female eels can live up to 104 years.
My.
So they're really quite almost like living monsters. You can see why any young Maori child who saw an eel of significant size would be really kind of taken by it, and that's why the stories and the faith and the myth survive, because the eels survive.
You had said that some of the eels are eaten by these people and some aren't. How do they decide that? What's the difference?
Yeah, that's a good question. So some of the eels take the form of water guardians that they call Taniwha, and the Taniwha are not eaten, and they identify a Taniwha by, like, if they set their nets and they catch a bunch of eels, and one of the eels in the net is kind of acting a little strange, like either looks at them or has a red stripe or is white like an albino eel. Or if they take it home and they have it in a bucket or a basin alive, and I've heard lots of stories like this, and at night they'll hear the eel crying like a baby or barking like a dog, then it's identified as a Taniwha and they let it go. If you kill a Taniwha eel, then something bad will happen to you or a member of your family. Usually somebody will die or you'll die. And I heard many, many firsthand accounts of people who had interactions with Taniwha eels. And in other Pacific Islands, I heard stories from people who didn't even call them Taniwha eels, but similar stories where they talked of these giant eels that cry like babies. And one of the stories was of a Taiwanese exporter of eels who was exploiting these big eels, and he actually exported one of these giant eels that was crying like a baby. Mm-hmm. And he had these dreams where this army of eels was flying out of the sky and hitting him in the chest, and then he died of a heart attack. But you know, the eel is such a they're so big and so abundant that they really sustain the Maori year round.
Uh-huh. It's a very, very different sense of what the eel is from what we in the Western world think of. James, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
James Prosek is author of Eels, An Exploration from New Zealand to the Sargasso of the World's Most Mysterious Fish. You know, it's not that any food lover wishes Jane and Michael Stern ill fortune, but a lot of people would love their jobs. They coined the phrase road food with their first guidebook to America's down-home eats, and that was in the 1970s. Well, they're still unearthing dynamite finds for their road food site and for us. Jane, Michael, welcome, guys.
Hi.
Hey, Len.
So what's the latest?
Well, we have been refereeing the ice cream wars in Cincinnati, Ohio. I mean, nobody knows we're refereeing this, but we do. What that means is we have been at Grater's and
Aglanesis Brothers.
Right. Home of the two great ice cream sundaes in the Cincinnati area. You know, New England eats more ice cream than any part of the country, but I think Southern Ohio and Northern Kentucky is really catching up with ice cream mania.
You know, I just think you've talked about Grater's before.
Yes, and we focused on those wonderful thick chocolate chips and all their chocolate chip flavors. Aglamisa's, though, is a new discovery for us. It's a two-of-a-kind place. There are two of these places in Cincinnati, and they're real old-fashioned ice cream parlors with the pink stripes and the wrought iron chairs, and ice cream that is somewhat similar to Grater's, except it's not quite as creamy. It's more sweet than creamy.
Uh-huh.
So if you like really creamy, I would go to Grater's. If you like sweeter, I would go to Aglamisa's. Also, if you like pumpkin ice cream in the autumn, Aglamisa's is the place to go.
But you were talking about sundaes specifically.
Yes.
Yeah, and Michael, you know, with his turtle mania.
Turtle candy, right, et cetera.
Candies, yeah, and so
right.
forth. Coincidentally, both Grater's and Aglamisa's both specialize in turtle sundaes, which are vanilla ice cream with pecans, right, Michael? And caramel.
Caramel sauce and fudge sauce,
right.
And toasted pecans. I mean, that's,
it is pecans.
That is the turtle combination, yes.
You know, just a little aside, political aside here. Are these two ice cream folks aware that they are at war, or have you two just decided that they are?
Only on our tongues are they at war. No, I suspect they're not, because in fact they're such different places. I mean, Grater's is a significant chain of many outlets. Aglamisa's is kind of an old-fashioned place with just a couple. So,
well, you know, Michael and I like to stir the pot whenever we
yeah,
can.
Yeah, I understand.
The fact is, it's a serious issue. I mean, if you go to Cincinnati and have time for only one turtle sundae, where do you go? Do you go to Grater's or Aglamisa's? It's a real problem that we have yet to solve.
But side by side, sundae to sundae.
Well, you know, to me, what really makes a great sundae, and both of these places are perfect with it, is real whipped cream, not the stuff out of a can, and perfectly fresh, not rancid, freshly toasted nuts. And somehow in the Northeast, where we live, the whipped cream and nuts are always kind of like bleh.
Yeah.
But in Ohio, they do it correctly.
Okay, ice cream wars in Cincinnati. Two places you have to go. So the answer is, when you go to Cincinnati, you have two turtle sundaes.
That's the only way.
You bet.
Thank you, guys.
Bye, Larry.
Bye.
I can give you what you want. I can make your heart beat short. I can make you ice cream. We could be a sweet tea melting in your vice dreams.
Jane and Michael Stern are the proprietors of RoadFood.com. Okay, it is time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what is the connection between whales and hot chocolate? Well, we're going to be back with that answer in a moment, and we'll be talking to you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Well, we're going to be talking to you in a moment, so get in touch, follow us on Twitter or Facebook, or pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what's the connection between the whale and hot chocolate? Well, the connection between the two is in one of the first Italian recipes from 1662, to be exact, for making hot chocolate. The recipe called for packing the chocolate for several days with orange, spice, jasmine flowers, and or ambergris. Now, here's the whale part. Ambergris is the very rare and very expensive secretion from the intestines of the sperm whale. Not the most tempting seasoning to us. But then people believed that it was magical and that the very, very wealthy got to eat it. I've heard that it tastes a little like vanilla, but the sperm whale is now endangered, so hot chocolate with ambergris is not going to happen. You can taste how good hot chocolate was in 1662 by checking out my recipe for the Duke's hot chocolate on the website, splendidtable.org.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves
loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
If it, seems it is time for us to talk. The lines are open. Give us a call, 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook or go to the website and shoot us an email, splendidtable.org. Anything goes. Okay, we've got Jan calling from Arlington, Texas. Jan, what do you want to talk about?
Tomatoes, Lynn. Your favorite subject.
My absolute favorite subject, that's tomatoes. Right. But wait a minute, it's winter.
It is winter, and you know they taste lousy and they don't look good. So the question is, when I switch over to canned tomatoes, is there a rule of thumb for converting your fresh tomatoes to canned ones? Like this one recipe I have calls for 6 medium tomatoes.
Okay, so 6 medium tomatoes. You know, if you look at the canned tomato, it's usually smaller than, it's a smaller tomato. So if it was 6 medium tomatoes, I would do probably maybe 8 or 9 of the canned tomatoes. I wouldn't seed them, and I'd throw in a bit of their juice.
Right.
And that would be it.
Okay.
You know, so figure maybe 1.5 medium tomatoes to 1 tomato in a can.
That sounds about right. I took about 3 tomatoes and set them down inside of a 16-ounce can once and went, I can fit a few more in there. So.
Yeah. I mean, it's really, it doesn't
It's nothing
really...
precise.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But, and also, if you're unsure, you can start out with a little less and then add later. But
more.
Canned tomatoes, I can't live without them.
No, you can't.
Hopefully that's going to get you rolling.
I hope so. It helps a lot. Appreciate it.
And start hitting the garden catalogs to know what you're going to grow this year.
Oh, yeah. Drool over those.
Yeah. Hey, take care.
Thank you, Lynn.
You take
Bye-bye.
Care, Jen. Bye. That's a good rule of thumb, for to equal a fresh tomato, about 1.5 canned tomatoes with some of the juice. Okay. Call us, 800-537-5252, or go to Facebook. We've got Wendy calling from Ireland. Wendy, hello.
Hello, Lynn. How are you?
I am very good. You don't sound like you're Irish, Wendy.
No, I'm not. I'm an expat American living in Ireland. I've been here for about 8 years.
I understand it's a great country to live in.
It's a wonderful country. It's been a great experience. I managed to ship the husband and kids off to the pub this afternoon so that I could...
You're starting the kids early?
That's the culture. And we have to, when in Rome, we must.
Oh, are we going to get emails, Wendy? Oh, I can't tell you how many emails we're going
to
get.
I just wanted to say, it's not as seedy as it sounds in America. It's a lovely family environment at this time of day.
Yeah, and from what I remember, boy, pub food can be fabulous.
It can, and it's getting better, thank God.
Yeah, well, Ireland's had this whole kind of renaissance of great food, right?
Been fantastic. I mean, the artisans, they always had a good raw product to work with, but
right.
These people are getting creative and they're so talented. It's a great place to be.
Oh, boy. Well, but you probably had a question. You didn't just call across the ocean to, merely schmooze.
No, I didn't. Although it was great. It's nice to have the kids out of the house. I wanted to ask you, speaking of artisan producers, I have a dear friend who has a smokehouse here.
Right.
And he does historic smoked salmon. I mean, it's amazing. But and he's been known all over the place. I send it over to the States. They love it. They think he's fantastic. He's just started smoked duck. Now, He's asked me to help him with recipes to use this smoked duck.
And what
I'm finding, Lynn, and I'm having a hard time with, is a lot of the recipes I see out there and a lot of the flavors I think to use are almost overpowering this duck.
Right.
It is a delicate, elegant, sumptuous thing.
I've had smoked duck.
Yes.
And, it is delicate, though. You don't want to rock 'em, sock 'em. All right. So I don't think you need to do a lot. Like, for instance, paper thin or just thin slices of it over a salad of greens, right, with just a normal vinaigrette dressing and maybe just a few nuts of some kind that kind of pick up that wonderful oh God, it seems so weird to say this, meatiness of the duck.
Yes.
Yeah, and the other thing, now it's smoked in a way that it doesn't have to be cooked, right?
Correct. That's the problem for me is that when I've tasted smoked duck before, there's a real strong smokiness to it.
Yes, I know. It's usually overpowered with smoke, but this doesn't
this
sound like
this is coming through just duck. Oh, gentle, sweet little duck.
Boy, oh boy. I don't see any reason why you can't put that on a plate. And, I mean, I'm thinking maybe this is, you know, very, very ordinary to you. But those potatoes in Ireland. No, but just think about this. If you could get your hands on some new potatoes, you know, the waxy kind,
yes,
that have that sweet undertone, you have a little bit of that smoked duck, and you could maybe warm it really gently in a skillet. Don't cook, but just warm it. That goes on the plate, maybe three strips of it. And then what you have is a little mound of those potatoes that you have either baked or mashed or simmered. Okay, but they're normally not potatoes you would mash. They're the potatoes you'd make potato salad with, you know, those waxy, firm potatoes. They have a flavor that's incredible, and you put some good local butter on those, and then have some tart greens. It could be, you know, cooked kale. It could be almost anything. It could be raw greens, even.
But you're going tart.
I'm going a little on the tart side.
Where I'm going wrong.
See, because I'm thinking the richness and the delicacy of the duck, that unctuousness of those potatoes that are just so delicious. Salt and pepper is all they need with a bit of butter, really good butter. And then some freshness in the greens that would really lift it. And you have got a plate of incredible flavors. And you don't fuss with reductions and spices.
Perfect.
And everything. I think,
and we're
showcasing
the Irish potato too.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect. Exactly. And you've got all that at your fingertips.
Okay, now let me just ask you one quick follow-up.
Sure.
Any thoughts on how I could do a smoked duck risotto?
Oh, absolutely. I would use he's doing the whole duck or he's doing the breast?
He's doing the whole duck.
He's doing the whole duck. Okay, I'd take some of the thigh and the leg.
Yeah.
And you know how you do a risotto where you saute onion in butter?
See, I'm sauteing the onion in the duck fat.
Well,
but I can't get enough duck going through the whole risotto.
Well, here's the trick. Okay, you're going to use the duck fat with some cut up duck, but smoked duck from the thigh or the leg. Then make the risotto the way you normally would. You know, you usually add some white wine. You saute the rice first, then you add white wine, then you add good broth, and then as you're about to serve it, where you normally would fold in something like the Parmigiano Reggiano. With a little less Parmigiano Reggiano than you would normally use, you fold in thin slice pieces of that smoked duck breast.
Mm.
You haven't done a thing to it. It's just going to warm, and you're going to get two levels of taste. It's the way you would work with herbs. Like, you would use fresh herbs in the sauté, and then you'd use fresh herbs at the very end. Same way you would build two layers of flavor with the smoked duck.
Okay.
Give it a shot. I think you're going to love it.
Perfect. Lynn, thank you so much.
You are so welcome, and you have made me want that duck so bad.
Come on over. We'll take you to the pub, and then we'll bring you back for some duck.
I would be very happy.
Lynn, thanks again.
You are welcome, Wendy.
All right, take
Bye.
Care. Bye.
She's in Ireland. She has this in her backyard. Anyway, 800-537-5252. Send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Jeff is on the line from Noonan, Georgia. Jeff, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn.
Hello.
I have a St. Patrick's Day dinner every year, and I corn my own corned beef, you know, sits in the fridge for 2 weeks.
Right.
Have the sides. Last year, I had a cabbage casserole that was very good and an individual rhubarb crisp for dessert.
Ooh.
And I'm looking for something different to go along with the corned beef.
So you've done the cabbage thing. I'd love to know how you did the cabbage casserole.
Oh, it's delicious.
That doesn't tell me how you did the cabbage casserole, Jeff.
It's the cabbage, and it's almost like a beurre blanc that's got like a creamy filling with the cabbage and then a breadcrumb topping.
Ooh.
So it's all buttery.
And crispy.
And it's creamy with the cabbage down in there. You know, not cooked too long. I still want to recognize that it is cabbage in there.
Right. I could deal with that. I could deal with that. Okay, so now we're talking, you want to do something different with the corned beef.
Right.
How far away from tradition do you want to go?
Oh, I can go as far. We do it for fun, not necessarily tradition.
Okay. One of my all-time favorite things to do especially with something like corned beef, which has all that great flavor. You slice yams into rounds. You know, they're maybe a quarter inch thick, and you drop them in boiling water. They cook in 10 minutes. Okay?
Right.
And now once you've got your yams, you have a choice you can make. You can rewarm them with some sort of sauce or a seasoning on them, or you can turn them into a salad very easily. One of the things that I like to do is when they come out of the pan, I film the bottom of the pan with olive oil. I throw in 5 or 6 cloves of garlic, a little bit of diced up grape tomatoes, okay?
Right.
And I throw in some chopped up ginger and orange peel.
Ooh.
The combination, I have to tell you, tomatoes with the ginger and the orange peel, it's really fabulous. You saute that until it's very fragrant, but don't burn the garlic. Obviously, salt and pepper. And you spoon that all over these. You've laid out those potatoes overlapping those, because they're really rounds, right, on a platter.
Right. Uh-huh.
And you just spoon that over it. And if you want, you can tear fresh basil leaves over it.
Oh, that sounds fabulous.
It is just delicious, and it's that bright yet sweet. You know, there's such lusciousness to the yams, and you put that next to corned beef, and everybody is going to love it. And you can either serve it warm or serve it at room temperature.
Oh, that makes it that much easier.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And then I'm going to go home and make your cabbage casserole.
Sounds good.
Okay. Hey, have a great St. Paddy's Day.
Okay. If you're in Newnan, come by. Have dinner with us.
Don't ask twice. Thank you, sir, and thanks for calling.
Okay.
Bye.
Goodbye.
800-537-5252, or shoot us an email, splendidtable.org. This is the prediction moment of the show. We're predicting that ketchup is on the way out. I mean, take a look at what's showing up next to the mustard on tables at the burger joints and the sports bars. A plastic squeeze bottle with a rooster on it and a bright red sauce called sriracha. It's hot, a little sweet, and it trips off serotonin like crazy. Well, as with so many creation myths, sriracha's origins are clouded in mystery. Some people say it's from Thailand. Others say it's all American. Well, Randy Clemens probably knows what this story is since he's done the Sriracha Cookbook. Randy, good to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
So where does sriracha come from?
Well, it's a Thai-style hot sauce, and there's a little town in Thailand called Sriracha. And basically, it's a coastal city, and they're very popular for their seafood. And it's a much different sauce than the sriracha we're used to here in America. It's a little thinner, it's a little sweeter, still good heat and good garlic. But the one that got here that everyone knows, the rooster sauce from Hoi Phong Foods, was actually brought over by a Vietnamese immigrant. He was born of Chinese descent, David Tran, and he'd been growing chili peppers in Vietnam, and you know, as so many were forced to do, he had to flee Vietnam for his, you know, for his safety, and so he left on a Taiwanese freighter called Hoi Phong, which is how he got the name for his company.
Oh, I see.
And when he found red jalapenos growing in California, he started to make chili sauce, and so it's a little different. It's they're two different beasts, and I highly recommend trying both versions. Uh-huh. I've always got a Thai version and the American version in my cupboard at all times.
So essentially, it's chilies, garlic, sugar, vinegar, right?
Correct.
And salt.
Correct.
Okay, so why do you think this thing is so popular?
You know, flavor first. And, you know, mind you, it wasn't that it necessarily blew up overnight. I mean, the Hoi Phong version has been around since 1983, you know, and of course the original even longer, but there's just something about, you know, before it was all over Top Chef and before you could get it at Ralph's, there was this sort of cult. You know, you were in the know if you knew about sriracha. It was just, you know, it was the rooster sauce.
Right.
You know, and just the fact that it lends itself to so many different kinds of cuisines and how complementary it is to food, you know, and having that heat level that's almost too much.
Yeah, but not quite.
Right. And the more you put on, the more you... You know, more it burns, but then you put on even more the next time, and it's a vicious cycle. Part of their success, I think, also, and I think they've attributed to this as well, is that their phone number, you know, is on every bottle. And before the internet and everything like that, you know, that was vital, and people would call and they'd order a bottle and they would ship a bottle to anywhere.
Oh my.
And, you know, they've never advertised, so it's gotten just this huge word of mouth following.
Okay, but this brings me to, we know about it in dipping sauces and on hamburgers and over hot dogs. What are some of the other ways to use it?
Well, I think there's a big thing to be made about putting it on things versus putting it in things. But putting it in your cooking really lends a different flavor. I mean, the core flavor of sriracha is definitely there, and it can be very complementary to a lot of other things, and certainly not just Asian food. I mean, I use it in a pulled pork recipe, ceviche. I've got a bacon sriracha cornbread, peach sriracha sorbet, and it's great with breakfast. Anyone can tell you if they've ever had their eggs with sriracha, it's really hard to go back to having it without.
Well, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
Randy Clubbins is the author of the Sriracha Cookbook. Try his honey sriracha glazed buffalo wings. You can find the recipe on the website splendidtable.org. That's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And until next time, let me leave you with this thought from Anonymous, who said, "The chili is the only vegetable that when you bite it, it bites back." Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. You will find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. Also at splendidtable.org is information on our newest book, How to Eat Weekends. Check it out. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson and Mary Beth Leone Gettin. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Chris Holacek. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.